Gregory. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie, et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons
qu'un. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Ted Wheeler's issuing a state of emergency to allow the city of Portland to more easily remove homeless camps. FEMA extends housing assistance by 6 months to help Southern Oregon victims of the 2020 Labor Day wildfires. And Washington State is testing and looking at new legislation about driverless vehicles. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 3rd, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. Portland's mayor plans to issue a state of emergency as soon as tomorrow. It would allow the city to remove houseless people from roadsides and other places that could be physically dangerous for campers. This comes after a big increase in homeless pedestrians getting hit and killed by cars along major roads. That finding was released yesterday in Portland's official summary of traffic fatalities. U.S. Special Forces killed the global leader of ISIS in an overnight counterterrorism attack. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
The leader of the extremist Islamic State group was killed in an overnight raid by U.S. Special Forces. The attack took place in northwest Syria. The raid targeted Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi, who became head of the Islamic State in October of 2019. The previous leader died during a U.S. raid in the same area. The Islamic State has been responsible for a number of recent terrorist attacks, including a 10-day attempt to seize a prison. U.S. Special Forces landed in helicopters and clashed with gunmen for 2 hours. Al-Qurashi actually died as the U.S. approached by exploding a suicide bomb that killed him and members of his family. 13 people, including 4 children and 2 women, died in the raid. There were no U.S. casualties. The region where the attack occurred is controlled by Turkish-backed fighters, but it remains an Al-Qaeda stronghold. It has been home to top ISIS leaders. Al-Qurashi had not appeared in public since he took over leadership of the Islamic State. The group has sent out beheading videos and asked followers in the West to commit acts of violence. At one point, it controlled 40,000 square miles of land from Syria to Iraq. President Biden said he ordered the raid, quote, to protect the American people and our allies and to make the world a safer place, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A Washington State bill would add guardrails to driverless vehicle testing. Companies are testing autonomous vehicles across 36 states, including Washington. As Eric Tegedoff reports, legislation in Olympia would bolster requirements for testing autonomous vehicles.
As more self-driving cars come online, some lawmakers in Olympia want to make sure they follow the rules of the road. House Bill 1731 would strengthen requirements for autonomous vehicle testing in Washington state. Sponsor of the bill, Representative Shelley Kloba, says the Washington State Autonomous Vehicle Work Group discovered there was a low bar required to start testing these vehicles.
There was no difference, basically, in what you had to do or prove or show or what kind of criteria you had to meet in order to drive without a human in the car. Nothing. There was no difference. And I think that was kind of concerning.
HB 1731 would strengthen these standards, as well as ensuring that relevant information goes out to first responders in the event of an accident, and that data on testing is accessible to the public. Opponents from the autonomous vehicle industry say these are onerous standards, not required in any other state. Industry groups are instead backing House Bill 2100, a similar measure with fewer requirements for sending data. Recent data from the U.S. Department of Transportation finds the first 9 months of 2021 were the deadliest on the road since 2006. Larry Shannon is with the Washington State Association for Justice and supports HB 1731. He says while driverless technology has potential, it still has a long way to go, noting that vehicles struggle to perceive animals and pedestrians or recognize weather patterns.
It's a promise that's being made to the public that we will have these vehicles that can operate safely and in our current and future driving environments more safely than human drivers. Given the questions around the current capabilities of this technology, the safeguards need to be in place and need to remain in place that are in this bill.
There have been several deaths involving self-driving cars, including an Arizona pedestrian in 2018. Shannon says every combination of car technology will be sharing the road as we move toward more autonomous vehicles.
We need to keep that in mind as we think about how we're going to control and regulate and integrate the different vehicles moving forward.
Both HB 1731 and HB 2100 are in the House Committee on Transportation. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
FEMA is extending housing assistance by 6 months to help victims in Southern Oregon who are still recovering from the 2020 Labor Day wildfires. FEMA originally allowed housing assistance for as long as 18 months after a declared disaster, giving the survivors of the 2020 fires until the middle of March to find new homes. But FEMA says finding permanent housing is tough, with a low amount of homes available. Housing programs in Jackson, Marion, Lane, Lincoln, and Linn counties are getting the extensions. A new study finds too many Americans, especially people of color and socially or economically disadvantaged populations, suffering from more advanced forms of cancer once they even find out they have it. I talked to Dr. John Williams, the chair of the President's Cancer Panel, which is encouraging more effective and equitable cancer screenings.
Good morning, Dr. Williams. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Anna. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, glad to talk to you. Tell me about this new report. You're talking about closing gaps. What are some of the gaps we're talking about here?
Wow. Well, we learned when COVID-19 hit in the spring of 2020, cancer screening for breast cancer, colonoscopies, cervical cancer screening dropped off by 90%. And it's slowly come back to almost pre-pandemic levels. But we learned initially that we can't let that happen again. So we have to protect our system and our cancer screening and make it stronger. But even more importantly, that our report on closing the gaps of cancer screening is really to identify that there's so many people that even in good times and non-disrupted times that we do not screen, and we need to find ways to improve and close that gap so everyone that benefits from cancer screening, such as lung cancer, cervical cancer, colorectal cancer, or breast cancer, gets that screening.
In your research, what are you about who is especially impacted by this lack of testing?
There are so many different populations. We have a very diverse country. It's what makes us strong. But with that diversity, there are many populations, whether they're geographic, rural, or inner city, or populations of color, or groups that speak different languages, or the American Indian community. These are groups that actually are vulnerable, and we get screening at a lower rate than the general population. So one of the biggest call to actions for us is to create an equitable system so we spend the time and the resources to bring them into the system. And we can do that with four goals, and we issue actionable recommendations to improve communications to these groups, but also to providers that serve them, so more people know about and get cancer screening. And we also have to engage community leaders, community health workers, and not only support them, but fund some to engage these specific communities to bring the messaging and the opportunities for cancer screening to these populations, so then they buy in and make it part of their daily health and also general well-being.
Do you have any data specifically or information, even anecdotally, about the Pacific Northwest? Because that's primarily where our audience is, in Oregon and Washington.
Well, one messaging that came through our public meeting, so the President's Cancer Panel works with all stakeholders and has public meetings about a particular topic, in this one, cancer screening. And we held public meetings, and they're all available online at our website, Press Cancer Panel, P-R-E-S, cancerpanel.cancer.gov. But what I heard, we had, for example, there are significant and large American Indian populations and reservations, for example, that are vast and rural, and the access to getting a colonoscopy is minimal in some and nil in others. And the access to getting cancer screening from a mammographic perspective is very difficult and is not implemented well. So you, in the Northwest, have urban areas, but you also have rural areas, and you have very diverse populations. So they all are unique, and that's what we found in our report, that we have to treat these different and address and engage all of these different populations slightly different ways. The one message to put on the evening news, so many people don't even watch that. And these are the groups that we need to communicate, but also we need to bring cancer screening to them and bring them the opportunity to get it and develop their trust so they engage in that and their families engage in it afterwards.
Mm-hmm. During the peak of the COVID pandemic, you said that we experienced a 90% reduction of cancer screenings. Is there an indication that people are going back to the doctor, that they're going back in for their screenings now?
We're doing a better job and people are coming back. We're probably back to 80 or 90% across the board as we were in the pre-pandemic era. However, even a 10% drop represents a dramatic number of people that are being diagnosed later with cancer, and also many more that will die of cancer. But the opportunity out there is the fact that we were still missing 20% of people that would benefit from breast cancer screening and 20% of people that would benefit from cervical cancer screening. We're missing 95% of those that would benefit from a relatively new screening modality. It is called low-dose CT scan screening for lung cancer. So those that have a high enough pack year history of smoking benefit from lung cancer screening, and 95% aren't getting it. So our recommendations are to fill that gap and raise everyone up as close to 100% of those that would benefit from screening.
And that was my talk with Dr. John Williams, the chairman of the President's Cancer Panel. While people are absorbing the competing rhetoric about vaccine and mask mandates, some healthcare workers say they're seeing death rates higher than ever. And they say that's why it's important to keep encouraging preventative steps against COVID-19. Mike Moen reports.
The COVID-19 pandemic is now 2 years old, and Iowa healthcare workers say they're working under a cloud of crowded hospitals and a public still not fully embracing preventative measures. But doctors and nurses are still pressing forward with key messaging. As January wrapped up, more than 900 patients with COVID-19 as a primary or secondary diagnosis were in Iowa hospital beds. That compares to fewer than 60 last June. Shortly before announcing his departure, University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics Chief Executive Suresh Gunasekaran said if it were up to staff, residents would be called every day to be warned about infection risks, as well as the pressure hospitals are under.
It's really difficult for healthcare workers to be under this much strain, to be at this much workload for what they perceive to be preventable illness.
That audio is courtesy of Iowa Watch. Healthcare workers aren't targeting any political groups, but they still stress the importance of vaccines and wearing masks amid backlash over mandates. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds is vaccinated, but has generally positioned herself against the idea of requiring people to take those steps. Reynolds recently called attention to longstanding nursing shortages as part of the strain being felt by healthcare systems. Jennifer Nutt of the Iowa Hospital Association says while that is a factor, political rhetoric isn't helping.
There are thoughts that if it was not as politicized and it was like any other disease that came out, that here's a vaccine, here's what works, there would not be the back and forth and political arguments about vaccines.
And as healthcare workers keep up with testimonials about staff burnout, Nutt says the public should follow the science and not pay as much attention to what politicians are saying about these issues. She says there's reliable data about the effectiveness of booster shots and how they can play a role in turning a corner in fighting COVID variants. Mike Moen, Iowa News Service. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Advocates for seniors are calling for vaccination requirements in nursing homes. As Suzanne Potter reports, they want to ensure that the homes make public their rates of vaccinations for their staff and their residents.
Advocates for Older Americans are calling on the state to require booster shots for people who live and work in nursing homes. AARP Nevada recently made the request in a letter to Governor Steve Sisolak and to Richard Whitley, the director of the Nevada Department of Health and Human Services. Nevada is third last in the nation for the rate of COVID booster shots among residents. Barry Gold with AARP Nevada says merely making the vaccine and booster optional has not worked.
81% of staff of nursing homes in Nevada have received the vaccination, but only 25% have received booster shots, and that simply is unacceptable.
AARP's COVID dashboard shows that 77% of Nevada nursing home residents have gotten the vaccination, but only 34% have gotten a booster. The letter also asks the state to make sure facilities are providing the personal protective equipment and testing that will allow COVID-safe visitation and recreational and social activities to take place. Gold says there are really important questions for loved ones to ask of a nursing home.
Starting off with, what is the status of COVID-19 vaccines in the facility? Are they screening and testing residents and staff in line with government regulations? What do they do if it's detected?
Check the AARP website for tips on best practices for nursing home COVID policies. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. At 8 o'clock, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies early, giving way to cloudy skies late. The low down to 33 overnight. Tomorrow's weather, clouds continue with a few showers developing later in the day. We'll get to a high of around 47. For our weekend, we're looking at partial sunshine, highs in the low 50s, lows in the 30s overnight. Today in history, on this date in 1953, French oceanographer Jacques Cousteau published The Silent World, a memoir about his time exploring the oceans. The quote of the day is from Jacques Cousteau. The sea, once it casts its spell, holds one in its net of wonder forever. The Pentagon shifts troops in Europe as tensions with Russia rise. A congressional subcommittee weighs autonomous vehicle regulations. And local news executives testify on big tech's impact on the news industry. With more on the news impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
The United States stands shoulder to shoulder with our NATO allies. The current situation demands that we reinforce the deterrent and defensive posture on NATO's eastern flank.
The U.S. government is deploying more troops to Europe as tensions between NATO allies and Russia continue to rise. President Joe Biden will be shifting about 1,000 Germany-based troops to Romania and deploying an additional 2,000 soldiers to both Poland and Romania. Last week, the Pentagon put an additional 8,500 troops on heightened alert. Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby says the U.S. is not providing troops to fight a Russian incursion into Ukraine, but is supplying Ukraine with weapons and supplies to defend itself.
I want to be very clear about something. These are not permanent moves. They are moves designed to respond to the current security environment.
The White House is ordering the National Archives to turn over former Vice President Mike Pence's records to the committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. The Hill reports former President Donald Trump objected to the move. The order comes after Jeffrey Clark, an official in Trump's Justice Department, met with the committee Wednesday. Clark reportedly used his position in the department to recommend sending notices to states urging them to delay certifying results from the 2020 election. The House of Representatives Transportation Subcommittee held a hearing on self-driving vehicles Tuesday. A coalition of industry officials, union leaders, and safety advocates are pushing Congress to adopt formal guidelines for the industry. Last year, Congress rejected such measures. John Samuelson with the Transport Workers Union says a federal framework for autonomous vehicles is necessary to protect the well-being and jobs of the nation's transportation workers.
We would strongly endorse legislation that regulates AV technology, holds new technologies to our existing safety standards, and ensures that this industry creates and sustains good union jobs in America.
The Senate Antitrust Subcommittee considered testimony on the tech industry's impact on local news organizations. Jennifer Bertetto with Trib Total Media, which operates the Pittsburgh Tribune Review and several smaller community newspapers in Pennsylvania, says Google and Facebook's hold on the news industry has contributed to news deserts in small communities.
Access to news online has become concentrated on two platforms, Facebook and Google, which serve as gatekeepers and determine how news is displayed, prioritized, monetized, without compensating the journalists that create the content they rely on.
President Biden has released a plan to cut the number of U.S. cancer deaths in half over the next 25 years, continuing a project begun when he was vice president. The New York Times reports the strategy authorized by Congress in 2016 was allocated $1.8 billion over a seven-year period. Roughly $400 million has yet to be spent. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Hundreds of people attend a virtual Wisconsin public hearing on Line 5. And a leader says Alaska Native corporations should have Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act eligibility. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Hundreds attended a virtual public hearing Wednesday about Wisconsin's draft environmental review of a $450 million plan to reroute an oil and gas pipeline. Danielle Kading reports Canadian firm Enbridge wants to move Line 5 after the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa sued the company to remove the pipeline from tribal lands.
Lawmakers, labor unions, and the state's largest business lobby touted the 700 jobs that would be created. Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany says the project would generate millions in economic activity and tax revenues while providing affordable, reliable energy.
Everything about this project is a win-win.
Tiffany said it also honors the tribe's request to remove the line from tribal lands. Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins rejected that notion.
The only thing we have ever asked of the oil company is to get out of our water. And that has been rejected. That has been disrespected.
Opponents say the state's review doesn't adequately address impacts to water, wetlands, treaty rights, and climate change. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute says Alaska Native corporations should be eligible to participate in the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act. President Dr. Rosita Worrell testified Wednesday before the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. The hearing examined the more than 30-year-old law's impacts and needs for the future. The law provides for the repatriation of Native American human remains, funerary objects, sacred objects, and objects of cultural patrimony. Worrell says ANCs were doing repatriation work for 20 years until a Government Accountability Office report on NAGPRA changed that. The 2010 report found NAGPRA does not include Alaska corporations within its definition of Indian tribes.
Collectors love Alaska Native material culture, and a lot of that was collected from all over the world. And so we started to do an inventory of all of our cultural objects and museums, and we finally quit at when we reached almost 100,000. And we were busy with doing repatriation claims, and we were very surprised, you know, when we were declared ineligible. We did a legal review, and we thought that we should have been declared eligible. But unfortunately, that was not the case. And in our region, repatriation claims came to all but a stop, except for our one regional tribe.
Worrell says it's not only a loss not to be able to continue work of seeking the return of ancestors and objects, but there's also cultural hurt.
In addition to halting the repatriation process, what was also halted was dealing with the trauma of the removal of our ancestral remains, dealing with the removal of our sacred objects. So we were not able to continue the path that we had been on in terms of our cultural healing from that trauma. So it had both the administrative, operative kind of things, but it also had an impact on our culture.
Worrell recommended the reburial of remains be allowed to return to where they were taken from and increased funding for tribes and museums. Other recommendations made to the committee, the administration of NAGPRA to move from the National Park Service to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, increased penalties for failure to follow NAGPRA, and measures to protect confidential tribal information. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
About half of Idaho's children have had at least one adverse childhood experience. Now the state legislature is taking up a resolution recognizing how that impacts people's well-being. Eric Tegedop has the story.
A resolution making its way through the Idaho legislature encourages educating state officials and agencies on the impact of traumatic childhood events. Adverse childhood experiences are common in the state, with nearly a quarter of Idahoans experiencing four or more. Those events include experiences such as physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, witnessing domestic violence, and family members in jail or with mental health issues. Boise pediatrician Dr. Thomas Patterson testified in favor of the resolution. He defines adverse childhood experiences as an experience a child is not prepared to deal with, noting that traumatic experiences can be buffered at home or in school.
So a child without proper social support, either in the home or at school, will end up in this toxic stress category, which permanently changes the way the brain is formed and its structure, but also in the way that it processes dangers.
Patterson says other states have recognized the benefits of education on traumatic childhood events. He cites the experiences in Ohio, where trauma-informed care has improved outcomes for children. House Concurrent Resolution 29 was reported out of the Health and Welfare Committee this week with a do-pass recommendation. Patterson uses a trauma-informed lens when caring for patients. He says a mom and her baby came into his clinic, having gone to the ER in urgent care several times. Both of them were crying, but Patterson pointed out that the baby would stop crying every time she did. He says he then asked her about her own traumatic experiences.
I didn't do anything massive. I didn't get her connected immediately with mental health services. I didn't reinvent the wheel. All I did was ask about her trauma, so she trusted me. And all I see that baby for now is well care.
Patterson says recognizing the significance of these events could signal a sea change in Idaho.
HCR 029 has the ability to be monumental in the impact that it has on our families and children in Idaho.
Patterson notes the pandemic has been a traumatic event for many kids. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOEV News for Thursday, February 3rd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Althea Billings, Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Mike Moen. The producer is Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Willamette on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. So glad you chose to join us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact. That's up next.
Making contact.
This is Making Contact. I'm Anita Johnson. Ever since the first Africans were brought to North America on cargo ships, Black women have helped build this country, now known as the United States of America. While Black women have played a critical role in the development of our nation, their stories, our stories, have been overlooked and intentionally left out of history books. In the new book, A Black Woman's History of the United States, historians Dr. Dinah Rami Berry and Dr. Callie Nicole Gross honor the many significant contributions of Black women who have worked tirelessly to build this country and fight for social justice in the face of racism and sexism. Today, we'll learn about some of these amazing women.
There was no way we could write a book and not feature Shirley Chisholm.